In your book, you talk about love as if it were a business deal of some kind. Isn't the essence of love that it is above self-interest?
Love, the currency is virtue. You love people, not for what you do for them or what they do for you. You love them for their values, the virtues which they have achieved in their own character. You don't love purposely. You don't love everybody indiscriminately. You love only those who deserve it.
And then if a man is weak or a woman is weak, then he is beyond love.
He certainly does not deserve it.
She was attempting to betray it. To portray that affair between them as totally rationally justified. She said it was nobody's business and we were sworn to absolute secrecy, but she said since they were such unusual people, it was inevitable that they feel what they felt, that there could be no objection to an affair. I also felt, I was very aware of how little Ayn Rand had had in her life from the outside, from other people. And I thought, okay, if I could press a button and make Ayn romantically happy, would I do it? And I thought, yes, I would.
That's not true.
I know. It was. I'm not proud of saying yes, but I said yes.
I know, it's happened. And this is one of my favorite parts of the house.
Where is Susan?
Beautiful.
Susan.
A corridor up here. And
she lives in this country club.
Well, the main
thing. And here the boats go by. Spend the night beside her. And you know, she's half crazy. But that's why you wanna be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. And just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, then she gets you on her wavelength. And she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover.
When the money comes out, the countries are devastated.
So it was not in the interest of Korea, and it was not in the interest of the United States. It was in the interest of a very small group of people who made their money from these speculative, these short-term capital flows, bankers and hedge funds. It was a really very small group in whose interest it was.
The Council of Economic Advisers decided to warn the president. They wanted to persuade him to stop some of the more excessive short-term speculation in the Asian countries. They came face to face with the Secretary of Treasury, Robert Rubin. Rubin had previously run Goldman Sachs, and under his leadership, the bank had created many of the computer models that underpinned the boom. Rubin had a revolutionary vision of a world system completely open to the free flow of capital. Joseph Stiglitz, who headed the Council of Economic Advisers, was convinced that the Treasury was stopping the warning speech in the president. He believed that Rubin and the Treasury had effectively become agents of the financial world, embedded in the heart of government.
Treasury had close connections with the financial markets. Secretary of Treasury had come from the largest investment bank and went afterwards into the largest commercial bank. And these are the people with whom U.S. Treasury naturally interacts. And to Wall Street, we were threatening a bursting of the bubble. To Wall Street, we were threatening their profits. So the Treasury worked extremely hard to make sure the president never got to consider the issues, making sure that the perspectives, the Council of Economic Advisers, which was here then, never reached the president.
So they kept your office from the president?
Effectively, yes.
What some people were beginning to see was that the computer networks and the global systems they had created hadn't distributed power. They had just shifted it, and if anything, concentrated it in new forms. And some of the computing utopians from Silicon Valley were also beginning to realize that the World Wide Web was not a new kind of democracy, but something far more complicated, where power was exercised over the individual in new and surprising ways. Carl and Thomas Sowell had been one of the earliest believers in the new communities of cybersense. Her online name was Humdog, and she lived on the West Coast. But then she lost faith, and she posted an attack which caused a sensation online. It is fashionable to suggest, she wrote, that cyberspace is some island of the blessed, where people are free to indulge and express their individuality. This is not true. I have seen many people spill out their emotions, their guts online. And I did so myself, until I began to see that I had commodified myself. Commodification means that you turn something into a product which has a money value. In the 19th century, commodities were made in factories by workers who were mostly exploited. But I created my interior thoughts as commodities for the corporations that owned the boards I was posted to. My CompuServe, or AOL. And that commodity was then sold on to other consumer entities as entertainment. Cyberspace, she wrote, is a black hole. It absorbs energy and personality, and then represents it as an emotional spectacle. It is done by businesses that commodify human interaction and emotion. We are getting lost in the spectacle.
She was blue, bluer than though that was the night.
In 1997, Bill Clinton made it clear to Monica Lewinsky that their love affair was over. Hurt and bewildered, Lewinsky poured out her feelings to her colleague Linda Tripp, who had become her friend. And in September of that year, Linda Tripp secretly began to record their phone conversations. At the very same time, on the other side of the world, the property bubble in Southeast Asia finally burst. Two enormous crises were about to engulf the world. One would strip the last remnants of power from Bill Clinton. The other would bring the global economic system to its knees. The dream of a stable world was about to be assaulted by the two uncontrollable forces of love and power. The Asian crisis began in Thailand. Hundreds of thousands of offices and apartments had been built, but no one wanted them. As the developers went bust, defaulted on their loans, Western investors panicked and rushed to take their money out of the country. The panic began to spread, first to South Korea. Housewives queued to give their spare dollars to the government to rescue the country, but it wasn't enough. Teams from the IMF came in, and they offered billions of dollars in loans to stabilize the country's economies. But there was a price. The IMF said that the reason the crisis had happened was because the Asian economies weren't Western enough. In return for the loans, they would have to turn themselves into models of the free market. This meant cutting government spending and getting rid of corruption and nepotism in the ruling elites. Then the crisis got worse. It spread to Indonesia. Indonesia was ruled by President Suharto. He was an autocrat surrounded by a corrupt clique of advisors and family members. He refused to do what the IMF wanted. So the IMF turned to the US Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin.
Well, our objective was not to reform the country for the sake of reform. Our problem, the problem that the international community faced, was that both the international markets and the domestic holders of capital were very quickly losing confidence in the Indonesian regime. And by that time, it was our view that if President Suharto was going to reestablish confidence, he had to deal seriously with corruption. And that was something that he simply was unwilling to do.
Robert Rubin and the US Treasury were determined to force Suharto to their will. In an atmosphere of growing panic in Washington, Rubin's team began to argue that the overthrow of Suharto might be the only way to solve the crisis. President Clinton was now increasingly enmeshed in the crisis over Monica Lewinsky, and enormous political power was passing to Rubin and his Treasury team. They, and not the State Department, were now running America's foreign policy. And everything was judged by whether it was a threat to the global economic system.
There is no question that the Treasury Secretary, in this case me, got involved in sets of issues that went way beyond what Treasury Secretaries ordinarily got involved in. But the reason was that there was real risk that if Indonesia had chaos, political chaos we're talking about, that could spread threatening the interests of the global economy.
In January 1998, Suharto gave in and signed the IMF agreement, watched over by the head of the IMF, Michel Cambiasu. Indonesia received a massive loan to stabilize the economy. For a moment it worked, but then the strangest thing happened.
Indonesia's currency has collapsed, losing 8% of its value, and the economy is in ruins. With riots and looting breaking out across the country, and fears that it's now on the brink of anarchy.
Indonesia's exchange rate crashed disastrously, and the economy went into freefall. But Indonesia was not alone. In every country that the IMF bailed out, like Thailand and South Korea, for a moment there was stability. And then the exchange rate collapsed. Rubin's critics in the White House began to argue that there was another agenda, also at work in the bailouts. But part of their real function was to rescue the Western investors, not the countries. Billions of dollars were paid into the Asian banks by the IMF, but many of those same dollars were immediately used to pay off Western investors who wanted to get their money out of the country. And once that had happened, the economy crashed. It was another illustration that the interest of the financial community dominated over other interests by providing mega-billion-dollar loans. The IMF was bailing out the Western investors and leaving the taxpayers in the countries further in debt because they had repaid the IMF.
The effect of the cost is devastating throughout the region. In Indonesia, government subsidies were removed as instructed by the Western bankers. Prices soared, and within months, in a country of 200 million people, 15% of the male workforce lost their jobs. Economic output fell by 14%. As Robert Rubin had noted, Suharto was forced from power, but at a very high price. The economy now lay in ruins, and ethnic and religious strife began. The same thing happened in Thailand and South Korea. Millions and millions of people fell back into the poverty that they thought they had escaped forever. By the middle of 1998, the Asian economies had collapsed. It was the most catastrophic economic disaster suffered by any countries since the Depression of the 1930s. Financiers and Wall Street. And when faced by a crisis, they had simply used that power to rescue themselves. In the process, far from creating stability, their actions were leading to a chaotic and far more unstable world. To the leaders of the Asian countries, this was just as much a corruption of power as anything their governments were guilty of.
Power corrupts. As much as government can become corrupt, when invested with absolute power, markets also can become corrupt when equally absolutely powerful. We are seeing the effect of that absolute power today, the impoverishment and misery of millions of people and their eventual slavery.
I'm a lifeline to reality. I don't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. And then a young woman comes to my lectures, and I meet her, and I fall in love with her. And now the situation has got even worse.
So shocking, accusing him of utter irrationality, of betraying objectivism, betraying her. It went on and on indefinitely. And it ended with her saying, if he had an ounce of morality left, he would be impotent for the next 10 years. And then slapped him across the face 3 times and said, get out. He got out. And that was the end. It ultimately ended in absolute disaster for everybody.
Ayn Rand's anger and despair destroyed the small, perfect hills around her. The collective was torn apart by the revelation of her affair, and by her violent reaction at her betrayal. And by the early 1970s, Ayn Rand was left almost alone. She still lived in her apartment by the Empire State Building, and she took up stamp collecting. One of the few people who remained loyal to her was Alan Greenspan, who worked in New York as an economic consultant to Wall Street.
Speaks of in a way in which it stays there and does not just merely rot and bounce around and have within it, in a sense, an unstable future.
In 1974, President Ford made Greenspan the chairman of his Council of Economic Advisers in Washington. It was the beginning of Greenspan's rise to power. Rand was left alone in New York. But she wasn't lonely, she said. In her philosophy, all you needed was yourself, because you were the world.
I kind of think this whole thing is ongoing, that there is an eternity, and that we are going to be a part of that, that we aren't just corpses and graves when we die.
But we aren't corpses and graves. We are not there. But you understand that when this life is finished, you're not there saying, oh, how terrible the kind of horse. No,
well, this is true.
It's finished. And what I wrote, thought was a sentence from some big author, I don't unfortunately remember who it was, that I read at 16 and it affected me all my life. I will not die, it's the world that will end. And that's absolutely true.
We must not lose sight of our longer-run prospects, which have not been significantly diminished by these terrible events.
But it started badly. A week after the attacks, the American markets opened again. Dealers waited to see what would happen.
Our heroes will now open the marketplace.
It was a disaster. Immediately, the market suffered the largest fall ever in its history. Two weeks later, the Enron scandal was revealed. And it quickly became clear that it was only one example of a vast corporate fraud. Since the early 90s, many major corporations have faked profits and hidden their debts, helped by some of the major accounting firms. It seems as if the American economy might collapse. Greenspan took action. He dramatically cut interest rates again and again. His aim was simple, to encourage American consumers to borrow and spend. They and their designers were going to be the machine that stabilized the system.
For you, today's rate cut is the culmination of an extraordinary few days for central banks. It's all part of a concerted global effort to bolster consumer confidence and make sure those consumers carry on spending money, because that is what's keeping the economy afloat at the moment.
It was an enormous risk. By cutting the rates to almost zero, Greenspan was unleashing a flood of cheap money into the economy. And in the past, this had always led to inflation and dangerous instability. But this time, it didn't. A vast consumer boom began, bigger than anything ever before in history. But there was no inflation. Everything remained stable. It seemed that the system could manage itself without direct political control. But it was an illusion. The reason for the extraordinary boom was the very opposite. It happened because of a giant exercise of political power by a elite thousands of miles away on the other side of the world. The Asian countries, led by China, have decided that never again they put themselves at the mercy of America and its financial elites, as had happened 2 years before. So the Chinese Politburo created a system to manage America. They deliberately held their currency's exchange rate at a low level. This meant that their exports were cheap, and Chinese goods flooded into America. And to pay for them, American dollars flooded into China. But instead of spending the money on their population, the Chinese elites immediately lent the money back to America by buying government bonds. It was a perfect system of cheap goods and cheap money flowing into America, all controlled by the Chinese Politburo. And it was this that created the stimulus. Orgy of lending by the banks to the poorest and least credit-worthy borrowers in the United States. It was a mirror image of what the West had done in East Asia in the 1990s. And just like then, out of it came a vast property bubble. It is as if over $1 trillion has been recycled, wrote one economist, to a third-world developing economy that exists within America's own borders. The Chinese money had led America into a dream. But the reason that so many bankers and politicians questioned it was because of their faith in computers. They were convinced that it was the computers that had brought stability to the system. The machines created mathematical models, parceled out the loans, and then hedged and balanced them so that there was no risk. But then, in 2008, that dream collapsed. Alan Greenspan's vision of a new planet and Gordon Brown's promise of no more boom and bust were revealed to be fantasies, built on a wave of financial speculation. That speculation had happened because those running the financial sectors, in America and Britain, had promised that they could create a new kind of market democracy that would be stable. But again and again, it had led to the opposite. Chaos and instability around the world. And now, finally, that has happened in the very heart of the West. But yet again, just as in Southeast Asia 10 years before, those running the financial sector now mobilize political power to rescue themselves and protect their supremacy. They ask the politicians to bail them out, and they agree. And again, just as in Southeast Asia, the price is being paid by the ordinary people of the countries. But we are now living through a very strange moment. We know that the idea of market stability has failed, but we cannot imagine any alternative. The original promise of the Californian ideology was that the computers would liberate us from all the old forms of political control. That we would become Randian heroes in control of our own destiny. Instead, today, we feel the opposite. That we are helpless components in a global system. A system that is controlled by a rigid logic that we are powerless to challenge or to change.